the nonprofits are being punished today. What we're trying to do is to actually set them free and empower nonprofits. Data also helps the nonprofits because they are trying to tell their story, but just a picture of a desperate child is not enough anymore for a nonprofit to show the fine grain detail of what they're really doing. What happens is when we hear the word measurement, we automatically think punishment. The way to set nonprofits free and to empower them and to get out from the punishment that's happening in the sector is to level the playing field, give nonprofits a safe place to store their data that is self-reported. It is not judged. There's no ratings.
Living in a world of declining trust, and not to be negative, but that is the reality. And this lack of trust is having a material impact on people and corporations' willingness to make donations and give to charity. And so in the US, the amount of households that donate has gone down by 24% between 2000 and 2018, and donation amounts by individuals decreased 51% when you adjust for inflation. Yet high net worth households are actually increasing their impact investing. It's doubled between 2017 and 2020. So what's going on, right? It used to be that we would just give where it felt good. But many people, especially younger generations, are just less willing to give to charity unless they have proof of how the funds are being used and the impact that it's having. So according to a survey published by Fortune, 72% of people who increased their charitable contributions said it was essential to trust a charity before giving. And 1/4 said that they would probably donate more if provided additional information about the impact of their contributions. So generally, the population is demanding more transparency, more data. And corporations, especially corporate foundations and boards and senior executives who fund social responsibility investments, are demanding more data. And this is increasingly true in the past few years as we've experienced a more constrained economic environment where every investment needs to demonstrate ROI. So why should charitable giving be any different? The problem, though, is that measuring social impact is a hell of a lot harder than measuring something like carbon, for example. And there's no universally accepted definition of the different outcomes in this realm. So whether that's access to food, financial literacy and skills, career access and readiness, or physical and mental well-being of children. Like, there's no general acceptance of a single way to measure these things across nonprofits, let alone across companies who invest in these cause areas. But there are people who are doggedly working on this problem with the belief that transparency and standardized outcomes reporting will unlock more giving and bring some much needed trust and confidence in a sector that's been, known more for helping people feel good than really do good. So today's guest is Jason Saul, one of the bold humans who has dedicated their lives to cracking the nut on standardized impact measurement. So Jason is the CEO of Impact Genome Registry, as well as the executive director of the Center for Impact Sciences at the University of Chicago. He's also the founder and CEO of Mission Measurement and has authored 3 books about measuring impact, the first of which came out 20 years ago, which is, long before most of this was on people's radars, and maybe longer than some of our listeners have even been alive. So ever since, Jason has been developing new methods to standardize, benchmark, and predict social outcomes, such as a cleaner environment, improved equality, safer communities. And he advises governments, corporations, nonprofits on how to track and share the good that they're doing in the world. Most recently, Jason and his team designed and launched the Impact Genome Registry, the world's only standardized impact registry. And so the Impact Genome Registry is a centralized database of impact data on more than 2.2 million global nonprofits and social programs, and nearly 5,000 of these have registered and verified the outcomes of their work. So work like this is really setting the groundwork for a whole new approach to giving, one that is much more science than art, and one that has the potential to bring more funding and donors, but not without its own hurdles and challenges. And I think Jason will be the first to agree with that. He knows this world better than just about anyone. So welcome, Jason.
Hey, Sona. So glad to be here. I love that you're digging in on this.
Awesome. Well, it's great to have you. And I think you're coming in from Chicago, where you live and work.
Yes. Appropriately, I am literally sitting right across from the great Chicago Fire Department. So let's hope we don't have another great Chicago fire. But we're definitely going to set this sector on fire. So let's throw some sparks here, Sona.
Awesome. Let's do it. So why don't we start right at the beginning, Jason? Let's define some terms for people. Impact data, measurement, reporting, standards. Help us out here.
Yeah, that's great. So this is a real alphabet soup, and let's make it really simple. So let me break it down. So impact is the ultimate change people want to see in society. Things like reduced poverty, things like more peace and tranquility, things like reduced violence in a community. Right, those things are population level changes that no one program or nonprofit can probably achieve and that take place over a long period of time. So that's what impact is, basically a longitudinal or long-term change in society. But when you break down impact, the building blocks of impact, the kind of amino acids, if you will, of impact are what we call outcomes, right? Outcomes are the changes in status or condition or behavior for individuals. So whether we want to get somebody job ready, or we want to get somebody employed, or we want to reduce the risk of a kid getting involved in a gang, or whether we want to get someone more likely to pursue a career in science or technology, those are outcomes. So those are changes in status, condition, or behavior that someone can achieve typically within a year. Measurement or metrics are usually indicators that indicate progress towards the outcome. Metrics usually don't measure the outcome, right? So if you're trying to say the outcome is I want someone to be reading proficient, the metric is usually how many books a day are we reading or how many hours a week are we reading? You could read 5,000 hours a year and still not be reading proficient. It's just an indicator of progress. So that's a metric. Evidence is the accumulation of data to prove that you've achieved the requirements of the outcome, right? So what claims can you make to prove or to demonstrate that you've achieved the outcome? And finally, standards are the common language that we use for outcomes or for metrics or for anything. So a standard is a common practice or a common terminology.
Okay, that's super helpful. And I think actually that segues nicely into the next question I had, which is around the genesis of the registry. Can you help us understand a little bit about what prompted you to start that?
Yeah, it's really funny. You know, I went to law school, and at law school, we studied thousands and thousands of cases. And those cases were indexed according to something called the Westlaw Key System in these databases or registries of case law called Westlaw or LexisNexis. And so we were able to navigate our way around the case law and find the case that matched the legal requirements of what we were trying to litigate, right? And the way that those registries or databases of case law were organized was according to an index of codes. What jurisdiction? What was the matter of law? Who were the people that were litigating? And so you could basically find the case law. And so as I started thinking about social impact, because I went to graduate school for public policy before law school, I started thinking about, well, how would this apply to the social impact world? Right? Where's our registry? Where's our index? Where's our set of knowledge and precedents? How do we organize all this information about what works? And if you look at every other realm of the economy, we have a registry. We have a registry for DNA. That's why you and I could spit in a cup and send it into 23andMe and find out our genetic match, because there's a registry of everybody else's DNA and all the research. There's a registry for financial information about companies or about individual credit scores. So those Experian or Equifax are registries of that type of data. And as I mentioned, there are legal registries. So as we started to focus more on like trying to change the world, and I started something called the Center for What Works back in 1994, which is now how many years ago? 30? I think I was like whatever, 25 years
old. You must have been 12.
Yeah, exactly. It's right about that. And at the Center for What Works, I wanted to figure out what works, right? And we were all in grad school. And we're like, hey, how do we figure out what works? We all want to change the world. But there was no registry. There was no index, there was no database of knowledge about what works. And that's what was really the genesis of all of this, Sona. And then just snap to present, I left law and became a consultant. People wanted to hire us, and particularly me, to measure what works. And I started measuring what works over and over again. And many of the programs were trying to solve the same thing. Yes. I remember at one point we measured the impact of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math grants for a company called 3M. And they had a program called Spartacle. And so we put all the research together and we accumulated it. And we said, all right, here's how you measure it. And then we got a call from Intel and they said, hey, we have these STEM grants. Can you help us measure the impact of that? I'm like, just literally did that, but okay. So we do that. And then Microsoft's like, hey, we have these STEM grants. Can you help us measure the impact? And then Adobe said, wait, we have this Adobe Youth Voices program. It's a STEM initiative. Can you help us measure the impact? And that is what triggered, like, we've got to stop the madness. Because one, we are recreating the wheel every single time we give a grant. They're all aiming at the same outcome. And when I looked at hundreds of those STEM grants, I realized that there were only three outcomes. Either one, you're trying to increase interest in STEM, particularly among young girls or minorities. Two, you're trying to increase STEM proficiency to get kids smarter at math or science. Or three, you were trying to increase STEM persistence, meaning you're trying to get kids to pursue careers in STEM. All the grants were aiming at the same three outcomes. So it was like, why are we recreating these outcomes and these definitions over and over again? And oh, by the way, for Intel and 3M and Microsoft and Adobe, we created different databases and collected data from the same grantees in many cases, like First Robotics and First Lego and others, in these different databases because every funder wanted different data. So at some point it was like, wait, we got to stop the madness. And that is what gave birth to the idea for the registry.
Yeah, I think madness is exactly the right word. And yet we continue to do it, right? Like it's just the way it's been done. And I think there's just a need for a lot of us to feel like what we're doing is special and unique. And so some of that drives that behavior. But one of the things I'm interested in asking you about is, you know, obviously this impact is being delivered by nonprofits. And so I'm curious about what makes the registry or the approach that you're using different from other ways that nonprofits typically measure their impact?
Yeah. Well, so there are only two ways that nonprofits measure their impact today. So one is they collect whatever metrics they can themselves and they report it out. We trained this many people, we held a conference, we went and met with a bunch of kids. So one way is nonprofits measure things themselves. The only other way is they hire an evaluator. And so those are the options that nonprofits have. And neither are really workable or scalable. Every nonprofit measuring themselves with their own idiosyncratic or unique way does not, one, allow anybody to understand what they're doing in a common way. Two, it compounds the pain because every funder is asking them for different metrics. And they have to scramble and create different metrics. So the DIY approach to measurement is really not working for nonprofits. It's also burdensome and confusing, and they don't know, and they have the skills or in-house capacity. And the other approach is outsourcing it to an evaluator. And I used to be one of those guys. And you have to hire a third party to come in and judge you and crawl through your program and write up findings over the course of a year or two. It costs oftentimes hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that is also not a good solution. So we're forcing nonprofits to choose between two unacceptable binary choices. And so the registry is really the third way, right? The registry is a self-reporting system. It's almost like, think about like the IRS in the United States or the CRA in Canada. We self-report our taxes. We use either TurboTax or we just fill out the form and we submit it. But we don't have an evaluator or an auditor for all of our individual taxes. Most of us, we self-report it. And we report it in a structured, standardized way. According to some rules and guidelines and common terminology, into a central place. That's really the same thing as a registry. It's the same thing when we spit in a cup and send in our DNA. It's all structured and standardized. And so the registry is really a new tool for nonprofits to be able to store and verify and promote their impact. So a nonprofit is able to store their impact data in a registry. It's their data. We verify that it's complete and accurate, and then anybody can access that information. So they can push their impact to any donor. Donors can access that data through partners like Benevity. And the registry is really a tool for nonprofits to own their impact.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that in a bit. But I was just, as you were talking, reflecting a bit on when we first met, which was 2019, Jason. And at the time, I remember the first time I met you, I remember thinking to myself, I didn't say this out loud, but I was like, this guy's kind of a rabble rouser and a bit of a troublemaker. And, you know, people just don't always like it when you take the heart out of charitable giving, right? And you try to distill their work and their hard work and their noble work into a framework that simplifies it down to its, you know, bare bones or its amino acids, like you were talking about before.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was recently having a conversation with a common peer over at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And, you know, he mentioned to me that there's a lot of known biases in giving, right? Like humans are very subjective creatures, especially when deciding which cause we want to support. And the thing that he said to me that I thought was so interesting was that, and we're comfortable with this subjectivity in this domain. You know, so we're not actually looking at data and we're okay with that. And yet the research shows that when we know the impact of our giving, we're much more likely to feel happier and experience a sense of well-being. So this has come through academic research. And I know this from experience, like when I know what the impact I'm having, I feel so much better about it and better about my life. So I'm just curious about how you think about all of the, you know, this and the role of data in this domain.
Mm-hmm. It's a really good question. So I don't think about data necessarily as hard data analytics, analyzing nonprofits purely by their numbers. I think about data as a common set of codes. So, for example, if you are a donor and you subjectively, personally, whimsically want to give to the arts in Chicago, data allows you to find organizations that match not just the arts, but what outcome in the arts. So do you want to sustain arts institutions? Do you want to increase access to the arts for underprivileged kids? Or do you want to help artists make a living wage and be financially self-sufficient? Those are very different outcomes that are data. Meaning, if I'm a donor, I can subjectively want what I want, but I still need some guidelines, codes, taxonomies, common language that helps me find what I want. And so data isn't necessarily inimical to a subjectivity. It actually enhances it. It allows us to find the characteristics about the organizations. It allows us to be able to match the organizations. It allows us to understand what type of impact we really want. And yes, there is actually hard data about the results of those organizations, which a donor may or may not care about. But even if they don't care about the results, data will still help them find, connect to, and understand the purpose of that organization.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, right? Like it's been a missing piece. And so all you're doing is just adding another tool that people can use to sharpen maybe their decision-making process, inform it, help them identify causes that they may have an affinity for. I like that, right? It allows a much more holistic approach because I think people, you know, going back to what you said earlier about being kind of binary in the way nonprofits had a choice to measure, I think people feel like data is in opposition to feeling or giving from the heart. And I think they don't have to be.
Well, and in fact, you mentioned the Gates Foundation. When you talk to the people who run the Giving Pledge of the Gates Foundation, they will tell you that the majority of the donors have not honored their giving pledge. And the reason why, if you really double click on that, is that they will say that one, it isn't easy for them to give. They don't know where to give. They don't know who's going to achieve the desires they want. And so there's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines. And so data on some level is a way for them and others to unlock giving. And when you mentioned this next generation of people that want to give, it's not necessarily that we need to be data driven. It's that we need, as you said, to have a more robust understanding of what this organization does from the donor's perspective so that we can really understand who's going to pull on our heartstrings, who's going to meet our goals. A picture isn't enough anymore. We want to know who's being helped, where are they, where do they live, what are they going to look like when they are helped, how much is it going to cost to help somebody, how far is my dollar going to go, and On the other side of this, Sona, data also helps the nonprofits because they are trying to tell their story, but just a picture of a desperate child is not enough anymore for a nonprofit to show the fine grain detail of what they're really doing. And so they need data. And again, I use data with quotes around it, data in terms of codes and common language and information to truly flesh out their story and tell the story of their impact.
Yeah. And I think that's especially true in the corporate domain, right? Like companies absolutely need more of that. So I just want to turn to that use case a bit. So I'm sure you know CECP, Chief Executives for Corporate Purpose. They reported that 94% of companies collaborate directly with nonprofits to select outputs and outcome metrics. And yeah, I know.
That's not a good thing, right?
That's not a good thing. No, that's not a high number is a good thing. No,
collaborate is a euphemism, right? Collaborate is a euphemism. A lot of times what you find is I was sitting around the Thanksgiving table last year, and on one side of me was a friend who worked for Google.org. And another side was a friend of hers who worked for Meta in their philanthropic giving. And both of them told me that they were pulling their hair out trying to figure out what metrics they should invent to foist upon the nonprofits that they were giving money to. I don't think it's good for either side, but keep going.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I do think that in the corporate context, you feel the pressure to prove. And so you're looking for the right measures and you're trying to find the perfect measure. And because those measures aren't well known or understood or standardized or don't have a common language, like you said, we start to try to create it ourselves. And so that actually leads to my next point. So 94% of them collaborating with nonprofits. I'm not sure nonprofits would say they're collaborating, but, and 65% of companies use internal and manual resources to measure outcomes and impact of the grant. So like just going back to the madness of the inefficiency, like what things do we do manually in a work context anymore? So I guess I'm just wondering, like, why are more companies not using a registry like yours to capture and verify impact?
Well, you know, frankly, they just don't know about it yet, which is why we're working with you guys and others to really amplify the message. So it's taken us a good 6 years to build the registry. We had to build standards and a common language for every area of social impact. Because if we just did it for one area like hunger, people don't only make grants in one area. So you can imagine building outcome classifications for 132 areas, creating peer review and definitions of what it means to achieve an outcome, building the actual taxonomies and the registry and the technology and the systems and the methods. So it took us a good amount of time with a lot of philanthropic investment to build the registry. And then for the last couple of years, we've been doing pilots and proof of concept with some of the biggest governments, the U.S. government, Department of Health and Human Services, the Canadian federal government, the government of Ontario, with Gates, with Google, with a lot of major corporations. And now we're ready to scale it. So I think the sector is ready for it. I think there's a lot of madness and redundancy and pain and cost and inefficiency that everybody wants to get rid of. And they're looking for a solution. And this is the most practical, affordable way to do it. You can't afford to hire an evaluator for every one of your grants. And as you say, you can't afford not to evaluate your grants these days because corporations have to justify their budget. So there's got to be a scalable solution. And this is it.
And I think it's a good thing. I actually think it's a good thing. We should be held accountable to the investments we're making, social or otherwise. And so you kind of touched on this, but if there is something deeper in here, Jason, I'd love to just explore it a bit, like around who is adopting this approach. So I'd love to know more at an archetypal level or like a persona or an industry or a company side. Like, are you seeing some trends and patterns in who is adopting this and, you know, why they're using it?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So they'd fall into three categories, right? So let's say the first category is compliance. So these are either governments or large financial services institutions, corporations that are giving away money and need to be able to report publicly about their impact. So they can't just trust some consultant to make up a bunch of metrics. They need auditable, assurable, standardized, independently verified information to make public claims about their impact. So let's call this sort of compliance or public reporting is the first use case. The second use case are, let's call them hardcore impact-driven people. So these are people who are early adopters who have long struggled to solve this problem of measuring impact. And many of them have worked in nonprofits themselves, and now they're in a position of influence giving money away. But they are people who want to solve the problem because they're intellectually curious and it is built into their mission. So I would call those the early adopter types. And the third type are the types who want to reduce the burden on the nonprofits. They don't have a compliance requirement. They're not necessarily curious about their impact as a funder. They just want to reduce the burden on the nonprofits. And they know the pain that they're putting their grantees through, and they can't stand it anymore. And so those are the third category of people that are family foundations. These are philanthropists. These are sometimes corporations or governments. And they're people who just like, hey, let's empower the nonprofits to own their data and give them a tool.
Yeah, I think that last use case is probably a driver that I've been hearing a lot from companies and leaders is, you know, I think we came through 2020 and just started to see the burden that we were putting on nonprofits and the inequity. I think inequity generally became a very big theme. And so figuring out how to actually shift some of the power dynamics. And I am going to come back to the idea of the nonprofits owning their impact, but I want to just stick with this theme just a bit more because some recent data that we shared in our State of Corporate Purpose report was that 89% of social impact leaders are now being asked to show how their impact is being measured and calculated. So I can see that there are definitely some tailwinds on what you've developed with the registry. And our data also showed that the focus on impact measurement reporting among social impact leaders and corporations is like skyrocketing. So it's definitely an idea whose time has come, Jason.
Literally, the labeling of funds that used to be green or sustainable that were regulated about using those labels and having to prove evidence, the same labeling is now being applied to impact funds. So any investment fund that has the word impact in its name, at least in the United Kingdom, must actually have a logic model and must have evidence to prove that they're actually producing impact and not just use it as a marketing ploy. So I think you're right. It is a time has come on a number of levels, from that level all the way down to the compliance.
Yeah, just a confluence of macro trends, right, that are making this ripe solution for the times that we're in. And I mean, the good news is that, you know, investments in measurement and reporting, it's actually the number one area of investment for corporate social responsibility leaders. So it sounds like you're seeing that as well. Is there anything else that you think is fueling it, or are those really kind of the key, you know, the key factors?
Well, look, I think if I had to put my finger on it from the funder perspective, at least from corporations and governments who are probably the biggest adopters of the registry, it is one single thing. It is budgets being at risk. At a private foundation with an endowment, your budget's not at risk. You get the same amount of money or more every year. At a corporation or a government, you have to reclaim your budget every year. You got to make your case. And so those budgets, whether you're at a federal government, at a state government, or a provincial government, or whether you're at a corporation, you have to go make the case about why people should give you more money. It is a discretionary allocation. And as a result, the demand for outcomes is higher than ever. One, because the spending is higher than ever. And two, because people are switched on to the fact that this isn't just sprinkling leftover money around and feeling good about it. They're like, wait, you were supposed to do something with that money, right? Like, we're an engineering company. You were supposed to get more STEM graduates, or we're a healthcare business. You were supposed to reduce food insecurity in our patient population. Did you do that? Because we just gave you $20 million. So what happened? And why do you want another $20 million if you can't show me what happened with the last, right? So I don't know is no longer an acceptable answer.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking about the consumer trends that have probably driven that level of accountability, right? Like, Gen Z, millennials, have always had information at their fingertips. They're a little bit more skeptical about being told. And I think as they wanted more purpose in their interactions with brands as consumers or as employees, a lot of companies leaned into this kind of, amplifying their impact and their purpose as a PR and a marketing technique. But I think with that comes, okay, now prove it's not just PR and marketing, to your point, right? So,
well, and employees want to know, right? They want to make authentic impact. They want to know the company is not just doing this for marketing. So totally. Measuring impact isn't just for grants. It's also for employee giving and volunteering, because people want to know that their efforts were not for naught.
Yeah. And then when you think about mental health being one of kind of the big crises in the world, and really, burnout and mental health in the workplace is a big topic as well. You can see how showing people how when they come to work and they give individually, or they're part of a collective at the company giving and they're having an impact, we know that actually increases, oxytocin, dopamine, and enhances people's well-being. So not an obvious mental health. It's not a meditation app. It's getting to something much deeper. But I want to come back to the nonprofit theme, Jason. We've touched on this a bit, right? So when I talk to folks in the space about this, I hear a lot of concern about potentially punishing nonprofits that are small or grassroots organizations who, may lack access to the resources and skills to put time into measurement, or worse, maybe rewarding large nonprofits who are already really great at measuring and marketing or have the budgets to hire those evaluators. So, I think we've definitely seen a lot of companies instituting equitable practices and enabling, small and proximate organizations. It's a big focus in our space right now. So I just want to ask the question, how do you know you're not making this problem worse?
So, the problem is already worse, right? So nonprofits are being punished today. They have to report in duplicate ways to every single donor. They don't own their data. So when they fill out a report for a grant or from a donor, they don't know where that data goes. It goes into someone's grant system that they never see again. They don't control it. If they have to give information to a rating agency, they don't own it. They're judged by a third party. The nonprofits are being punished today. What we're trying to do is to actually set them free and empower nonprofits to mitigate those problems. So I think what happens is when we hear the word measurement, we automatically think punishment. When I hear the word measurement, I think empowerment, right? So it would be the same empowerment to say, if you are rewarded for understanding your DNA, you have to be a geneticist. But if you're rewarded for understanding your DNA and you can spit in a cup and everyone can have access to it for $99, then it levels the playing field. And so the way to set nonprofits free and to empower them and to get out from the punishment that's happening in the sector is to level the playing field, give nonprofits a safe place to store their data that is self-reported. It is not judged. There's no ratings. It's literally just categorized and tagged so that it's structured and people can understand it. But that's the way that we see what we're doing is really on a mission to be able to empower the nonprofits to own their data.
And that's generally speaking, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, will smaller nonprofits be at a disadvantage because they may not have resources, capacity, will certain organizations that are focused on long-term outcomes be disadvantaged? I'm just trying to understand, because you think of large organizations having a lot of resources, being really good at this stuff, with their evaluators and their hired people who do this. And so,
maybe
that's an assumption. You're right. But I'm just trying to get at so generally I can totally see how this is helping the whole nonprofit sector. But I want to make sure that as we do this, some nonprofits are not being disadvantaged compared to others, because we know that there's already not a level playing field.
Correct. Well, I say maybe kind of, cheekily, Sona, because what we found is a lot of the larger nonprofits actually have a very high cost per outcome and don't always actually have the best evidence quality. And some of the smaller organizations that are closer to the problem are having better results, higher effectiveness, better beneficiary satisfaction. So I think you're asking two things. One is, how do small nonprofits get to participate in a regime like this? And two, is there bias in the way the world is going to play out if this data is available? So first, on the small nonprofit side, it's a lot like TurboTax. So it doesn't, putting data in a registry meets you where you're at. You don't have to go collect anything new. You don't have to have an evaluator. You have to have a big measurement team. You store whatever information you have about your program, even if it's anecdotal, in a registry, and it's the best you can do. So first of all, it allows every nonprofit to participate. The second question, though, is will donors be biased towards nonprofits who have better data? I think what we have found is that actually it doesn't work that way. We've conducted focus groups among high net worth individuals specifically, and we show them a variety of different nonprofits, some that have perfect evidence, really strong evidence, and some that have very anecdotal evidence, but doing really innovative things or are working with a really hard to reach population. And their answer was, I don't only care about evidence. I don't even care if they're more expensive to reach certain populations. I want to help these populations, and I want to work with organizations that are smaller or closer to the problem. So the registry is really just an opportunity for nonprofits to promote their work. And just like in the stock market, some people want to invest in penny stocks. Some people want to invest in blue chips. Some people want to take risk on startups. Some people don't. I think all we're trying to do is make the information available and ubiquitous and even for everybody so that donors can make their decisions. And if, in fact, all donors only want to support big charities, well, then that's a problem beyond us to solve. But I think the very least we could do is create the transparency.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the one hand, I'm kind of surprised to hear you say, actually, small organizations, can have, more positive impacts and responses from their beneficiaries. On the other hand, I'm like, actually, that makes total sense. They're right in the community. They're often part of the community or have come, through the circumstances that that the people that they're helping have been through. They have right
less
down
overhead.
Less overhead. Lots of volunteer run.
Right. So when you look at the actual data, and we have looked at thousands and thousands of organizations, Sona, in many cases, the smaller organizations have a better cost per outcome, a higher effectiveness rate, and a better beneficiary satisfaction. So it's not all about a game. And I think this is part of moving from, let's say, the last era of evidence and measurement, which was if you measure, you are good. If you have data, you are considered evidence-based and good, to the new era, which is everybody has data now and everybody has evidence. And the question is not, oh, I have evidence, therefore I'm good. It's how good are you really? What are you really doing? Who are you really helping? And so I remember a year or two ago, we were talking about like top 10 lists. Is there a top 10 list for charities for reproductive rights or for charities that are helping, women's empowerment? There is no such thing anymore. There isn't such a thing as you're better. It's you're better for what outcome, for which population, with what degree of innovation and what degree of risk that you want to take.
Yeah.
Just like stocks, there isn't one that's better. It's all about relative and, as you say, subjective interest, which is, I think, the point. I think a lot of people think when it comes to measurement and registries, it's all about we're only going to invest in the biggest and the best with the best evidence. And we're hard-nosed, green eyeshade investors. It's actually not. It's a lot like the founders of Morningstar here in Chicago told me about how they invented Morningstar, Joe Mansueto. What they told me was a lot of the investors didn't even know who the mutual funds were or what their holdings were. So the first thing that Joe Mansueto did when he started Morningstar was he actually just reached out to all the mutual funds and said, just tell me what your holdings are and I will categorize them, but I won't judge you because the investors don't even know who you are. And so their advice to us was focus on standards, standardization, categorization, and transparency. Don't rate or judge anything. Yeah. Make it available and let the donors or the investor choose what they want.
Yeah. Yeah. It's multidimensional. And I think it's about transparency to enable the kinds of decisions that people want to or need to make based on the criteria that's important to them. Totally. So One thing about the registry that I think we've talked about is that you're measuring outcomes on a 12-month basis. And I think we know change doesn't always happen on a 12-month time frame, although, gosh, wouldn't that be great? So I'm assuming that the registry may bias towards short-term outcomes, which are, you know, typically for direct service nonprofits like, you know, shelters, food banks, that kind of thing. So my worry is that we're not, you know, investing in then systemic change. Like, is the registry not helping us do that, or advocacy or long-term behavior change? So like, that just feels uncomfortable to me. I'm kind of a long-termist. So help me out. I want to make sure that we're not, you know, encouraging short-term thinking and behavior.
Sure. Fair enough. Well, I think like you saw with Elon Musk wanting to build a spaceship to get to Mars, you got to go to the moon first. Right. And so I think outcomes and impact is progressive, meaning impact is a long-term change in society. No one organization can really make like fully own impact. So if you think about breaking down impact into a series of outcomes that are progressive, I am getting a kid to have social and emotional skills and helping them to do better in elementary school. That outcome will build upon the next outcome, which is then I'm going to help them with student achievement and do better and get into college, which will build on the next outcome, which is college persistence and completion, which builds on the next outcome, which is workforce, you know, in employment and workforce access. So outcomes are progressive. And my point is that, and let's hold aside the system change work for a minute. I'll get to that. But even in the direct service work, outcomes happen over time. And so any nonprofit can achieve some outcomes in a year. And what we found looking at anywhere from short-term outcomes for like this month to long-term outcomes to like 3 or 4 years is that the right parameter is 12 months. You can achieve intermediate outcomes that are both meaningful and relevant and not just outputs like training somebody, but that it's still a valuable time frame to report what you're doing. So we think about basically the outcome is a common unit of measurement and capturing it in different stages. Even let's talk about system change or you know, policy work or anything like that. That's progressive work too. And we've broken that down through all of the research we've done into outcomes. So if you say, all right, we want to reduce corruption in a country. Well, first, you need to raise visibility of the issue. That's an outcome we can do in a year. Second, you need to build effective stakeholder coalitions. Get the right influencers on board. You can do that in a year. Third, you want to influence and pass legislation. You can probably do that within a year. Fourth, you want to be able to enforce that legislation and be able to make sure that there's the supports to reinforce it. So I think what we have found working with so many organizations is that the unit size of an outcome can be defined realistically in 12 months. And any nonprofit, even if they're aiming at a long-term theory of change, can break their theory of change down into intermediate outcomes that they can report on as they go.
It's interesting. I was envisioning building blocks. It's just, you know, it's like these different blocks. And so corporate donors, individual donors can actually think about where they want to target their funds in a life cycle of change. It's interesting. I hadn't thought about that before.
It is. I mean, all of social change is about a theory of change or about a series of building blocks. And I think we have lacked a language. We have lacked a science of impact, which is why I created the Center for Impact Sciences at the University of Chicago, because we're trying to create a more scientific way of looking at social change. Science is based on standardization, generalizability, and prediction. We can't do that if everything's just mushy and idiosyncratic. We're making up words for everything. And so you got to establish those amino acids, those building block outcomes. And so we're going to start with 132. There might be 140 or even 200, but there's not going to be 2 million. And so creating that common language enables not only nonprofits to be able to know, oh, I'm an arts organization. Yeah, actually, that's my goals. I'm really trying to help artists make a living wage and sustain themselves. That's really what I'm doing. So thank you for giving me outcome 26B, because that's what I do. I'm very different than another organization that's trying to increase access to the arts or whatever. And so it allows us to give a language and to make the data coherent so that donors can match, because no donor wants to support education. That's just a big empty word. They either want to help certain people get certain results in certain communities.
Yeah, it's occurring to me. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I started out skeptical about this whole 12-month thing. But what you're actually helping me see is, you know, it's easy to dwell in the problems when they're so big and long-term. And actually just thinking about the long-term can be paralytic. And so if you can actually break it down into 12-month outcomes, it actually gives people a path towards potentially like solving the problem, which is what all of us want.
Well, I'll just give you a quick anecdote. I remember working with the Chicago Community Trust, and there was an organization here called Ceasefire that was helping interrupt gang violence, run by a guy named Gary Slutkin, a friend and very famous guy. And they made like a 10-year, $10 million grant to Ceasefire. And every year, the board of the Chicago Community Trust asked Ceasefire to come and report about their results. And every year, the team came in and said, "We don't know. It's going to take 10 years to solve gang violence in Chicago, but we're working on it." So after the third year, the board said, "Hey, we're giving you another $1 million, but before we do, can you tell us your results?" And they said, "Well, we don't know. It's going to take 10 years. Guess what the board did that year? They didn't approve the money. And they said, at some point, we just can't spray money out there. So if Ceasefire had said at the time, "You know what? I don't know what's going to happen in 10 years, but this year we're going to get 1,000 kids off the street. And I can't guarantee you that we're going to prevent gang violence forever, but I can tell you that we are inoculating them against the risk of violence by giving them training and giving them certain developmental assets and protective factors. And we're going to get them jobs. And those things I can measure in a year." And that would have saved them. And so that's, yeah. I think, as I said earlier, the cost of "I don't know" is getting very expensive. And even though the big ultimate impact may take years, we have to have an answer every year of what progress we're making.
And I think that actually does two things. One is it holds us accountable to making change. And two, it actually gives us the energy, the well-being to continue down the path. Otherwise, it's really easy to become hopeless or pessimistic or, you know, cynical about this. And then to just say, "You know what, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to find another way to be, or I'm going to insulate myself from listening to the problems because I just can't have a sense of efficacy anymore." So I think what's really powerful about what you've just described is there's a beautiful balance here between, this data and information enabling us to hold ourselves accountable to change, but then also actually driving that sense of efficacy that will sustain us in what can feel like really difficult times, actually.
It's right, Sona. And that efficacy matters not only for the donor who is asked to give money every year and needs to evaluate, "Do I want to do this? Do I trust this organization? What are they doing with my money?" But it also matters to the nonprofit employees, who, if they don't know that they're making progress every year, they have nothing to hold on to other than this big dark tunnel of whatever they're facing. As you say, that's hopeless for the nonprofit team as well. So giving them an easy way to calibrate their progress is empowering to everybody.
Yeah. It's actually just good leadership in a way. So I think that's a great place to end. I think we might need to do a part two at some point. We'll have to pick that up because I've got so many more.
I got answers for you.
I'm sure you do.